water and other recyclables for reaction mass, and Zai had shot half the frigate's water supply and even a good chunk of the emergency oxygen that was kept frozen on the hull. The ship had gotten an additional bit of kick from ejecting the reflective bow armor with high explosives. They were now thousands of kilometers from where the Ricks thought they were, but they had almost no recyclables to spare. If they lost their main drive to enemy fire, it would be almost a year before the low-acceleration rescue craft available on Legis could make it out to repair and resupply them. A single breakdown in the recycling chain, bacterial failure, equipment malfunction, the slightest nano-mutation, would doom them all. And despite herself, Hobbs wondered if the Navy would prioritize rescuing the Lynx. With a war on, there'd be plenty of excuses to delay chasing down a stricken warship that was flying toward Rick's space at 2,000 clicks per second. Lawrence Zai was still an embarrassment to the Emperor. They would all make good martyrs. Short bursts! 1, 2, 3, the sensor officer counted. Low power lasers now. They're looking for reflections. What are their assumptions? The captain asked. Ensign Tyre, who had been moved up to the bridge from data analysis, struggled with the limited processor power and her heads-down's unfamiliar physical controls. The silent-running passive sensor array was basically a host of fiber optics running from the hull to the same small, shielded computer the pilots had been complaining about. From where they're shooting, they seem to think we've doubled back on them at high acceleration. High acceleration? Hobbs murmured. But we obviously aren't under main drive. They're being cautious, Zai said quietly. They think we may have developed a stealthy drive in the last 80 years, and that we're still bent on ramming them. Of course, Hobbs thought. Just as the Ricks evolved from one war to the next, so did the Imperials. And the Lynx was a new class of warship, only 10 absolute years old. It had nothing as exotic as full-power stealthy acceleration, but the Ricks didn't know that. Kathary Hobbs turned the page of the captain's writing tablet, giving herself a clean piece of paper. With a few long strokes, she drew a vector line of the Lynx's passage through the battlecruiser's gravity cannon perimeter. Writing letters was difficult, but her fingers seemed to know instinctively the curves of gunnery and acceleration. Over her career, she'd traced the courses of 1,000 battles, imagined or historical on air screen displays. Her tactical reflexes seemed to guide the pen, rendering the Rick's firing pattern as the sensor officer called it. The two ships' relative velocity was still roughly 3,000 kps. It would take hours of acceleration to change that appreciably. Thus, the Lynx's course was practically a straight line running nearly tangent through the sphere of the gravity cannon's effective range, like a bullet passing through a dribble hoop ball at a shallow angle. While they were inside the sphere, the Ricks could hit them, but the frigate would pass out of range within minutes. "They've gone to higher power with a wider aperture," Tyre said. The Ricks weren't firing to kill now. They had reduced their lasers' coherence to increase the area they could cover. They were hoping that a low-energy hit would reflect from the Lynx, or cause a secondary explosion that would give her position away. In effect, they had replaced their sniper's rifle with a flare gun. "They're picking up the pace! I can see a pattern now! A spiral from our old course," Tyre said. "How fast is the spiral expanding?" Hobbs called, her pen frozen above the paper. "Outward at about 1,000 meters per second." Hobbs looked at the captain, her spirits lifting. The Ricks were sounding a vast area. They had assumed the Lynx was still under heavy acceleration, at multiple Gs rather than the micro-maneuvers they were actually making. "The enemy seems to have overestimated us, Hobbs," Zai said. "Yes, sir." Hobbs turned to another fresh page of paper, filled it with a line spiraling outward and dissected by radials from the center. A spiral grid. Thinking that the Lynx was still under her main drive, the Ricks were casting a wide net. But the firing rate of the battlecruiser's laser would have an absolute limit. In order to search such a huge volume, they necessarily had to reduce the grain of their search grid. The Ricks' net had wide holes in it. If the Lynx were broadside to the battlecruiser, the low-res search might have picked up the 2-kilometer-long craft. But the frigate was bow-on, her hull only 200 meters across from the Rix's perspective, and with the bow armor ejected, only naked black hull alloy remained to reflect the laser. Hobbs drew a small circle in the circular grid, a minuscule gnat slipping through the web of a spider looking for fat flies. "They're going to miss us, sir." "Yes, Hobbs, unless they're very lucky." first engineer. 199. 200. All right, shut up, first engineer Watson Frick shouted to the dogged ensign. Keep the count going, but silently. Let me know when you get to 800. Frick's skin tingled as if he were under a sonic shower. The ensign had been in positive territory, counting up, for 2 minutes. No matter how imprecise the count might be, the Lynx was certainly within range of the enemy's capital weapons by now. At any moment, a gravity beam might swing across the ship and mangle them all. They had at least another 600 seconds before they were out of danger. Frick's side still throbbed. Yes, a few ribs were definitely broken, as he regarded the hastily assembled armor plates. The last piece was in place. The hull alloy shielding was spread across the cargo area to maximize coverage of the ship. There were seams, even naked gaps, but he couldn't seal those without using cutting torches rated for hull alloy, and that would show up on the Rick's sensors like an SOS beacon. The problem was the plates were practically floating free, held to the bow hull only by strong lines and monofilament. Engineer Frick had counted on using the recyclables stored in the cargo area to pack the hull sections into place. But the containers were all empty, the water ejected. If the captain ordered any serious maneuvers, the hull alloy plates would tear from their uncertain moorings and crash through the ship like a runaway maglev. And there was no hardwired comm point here in the cargo bay, no way to reach the captain. Apparently, the designers of the Lynx had never imagined that the bow cargo area would become a prime tactical station. Frick realized now why Navy ships seldom even drilled in true dark mode. Doing without second sight was frustrating, but losing communications could be deadly. Pressure hoods up, Frick ordered his team. If the plates got free, decompression was a high probability, and it was cold here, this close to the hull. The ship was running on minimal life support, nano rebreathers for air, insulation to maintain internal temperature. You, he said, pointing at Rating Metasmith. The woman was the best athlete on the engineering team. In gravity, she was a dribble hoop demon and had the highest freefall workout scores on the Lynx except for a few Marines. Get back to the forward gunnery station and use the comm point. Warn the captain not to accelerate above 1/20. Understood, she said, and sailed toward the open hatchway with an effortless shove. Frick flinched as she soared through, missing collision with the hatchway's coupling fringe by a few centimeters. The first engineer sealed the hatch behind Metasmith. If the plates did get loose, his team might do some good here in the cargo bay. They could attempt some sort of damage control. Pick an armor plate and tether yourself, he ordered. And if you smell something cooking, it's you. Frick pushed himself toward the central armor plate. The plates weren't grabby, so he employed his pressure suit's magnets. He settled against the hull alloy, feeling its reassuring mass between himself and the Rick's gravity cannon. 5 minutes to go, as near as he could figure. The silence of the Lynx was awful. At least on the bridge they could watch the incoming fire, judge how close the shots were falling. But here in the bow, he and his team were hiding deaf and blind, not really knowing if their silence protected them at all. Commando. Hurd soared to meet the cloud-seeding dirigible, the rendezvous only 100 kilometers from the entanglement facility's wire. The recon flyer was at the upper limit of its altitude. The fans whined pitifully and the craft's electromagnetic stretched tenuously downward, a swimmer's toes searching for solid ground. The air was thin up here, but breathable for a Rickswoman. The dirigible came down to greet her, operating at the lower extreme of its functional altitude range. Thus the two craft formed a precarious and narrow union of sets. Hurd rose slowly to a standing position on the recon flyer's armored carapace. The straining flyer reacted to every shift of her weight with the jitter of a tightrope. Alexander's piloting would be tested by this maneuver. Hurd had removed the military governors, giving control of the craft to the compound mind. She would have to go very high to approach the entanglement facility undetected. The dirigible, also under Alexander's control, came nearer, its sphere of emptiness looming like a black hole in the dark sky. The airship's tiny props tried to steady it, fighting the strong winds of this high place. Hurd's sable coat spread out from her, black wings against the stars. It was 25 degrees below freezing. For the first time in her life, the Rickswoman felt her fingers grow numb. Hurd steadied herself and reached for the dirigible's payload basket. She stripped the scientific instruments to lighten the craft, replacing them with the pack she had prepared for this mission. Then she removed the sable coat, which was too heavy to take with her, and sadly let it fall. She locked the muscles in her hands, leaving them arched like a pair of hooks. There was no provision for a person in the dirigible's small payload basket. She would have to hang from the airship until it reached the proper position. She knelt, gathered herself, and leaped from one craft toward the other. The recon flyer dipped away as her weight pushed against it, and a sudden gust of wind pulled the dirigible from her locked hands. A very human gasp escaped her lips. Hurd reached the zenith of her leap, then fell through the cold air like a stone. Captain. A runner in forward gunnery has a message from the first engineer, sir.
We have our promised armor? Captain Zai asked. It had taken long enough. Zai had questioned the value of reinforcing the forward cargo area in the first place, but the crew needed to feel that they were doing something to protect themselves. Unnecessary misdirection, as Anonymous 167 called these minor deceptions of one's own subordinates.
Yes, but the plates are not secure, sir, Hobbs relayed. Frick is requesting no maneuvers above 0.05 Gs. They could tear loose if we use the main drive.
Captain Zai cursed. I knew I'd pay for that armor.
They can secure it with torches, sir, once we get out of range.
By then we won't need it, Zai said. Hobbs nodded.
Zai flexed the fingers of his natural hand. Going to dark mode had apparently worked. The Ricks almost certainly weren't going to find them without a wild stroke of luck. In 5 minutes, plus another 100 seconds for safety, they could switch synesthesia back on. They would have communications, status reports. He would get command of his ship back. And he would be able to move again. At the moment, Zai's lower back was aching from holding himself rigid in the shipmaster's chair. If he relaxed for a moment, he would topple over onto the floor.
Any answer for Frick, sir?
No. We'll have communications back in a few minutes anyway. Keep that runner on station at the comm point in case something serious comes up.
Yes, sir.
The tone of Hobbs' voice showed that she agreed. It was odd, sitting here with her in the near dark. The captain's and executive officer's stations were physically close, but the two inhabited different worlds. Hobbs often seemed absent, adrift amid the myriad channels of the Lynx's infrastructure, while Zai tried to stay focused on the overall picture. He'd been an XO himself, and had to resist the temptation to wallow in the vast information resources of his ship. But the War Sage was unwavering on the importance of delegation. The captain left data mining to the ever-competent Cathery Hobbs. Here in dark mode, however, wrapped in silence and cut off from the rest of the Lynx, there was an unfamiliar intimacy between them. Zai had always rated Hobbs an excellent officer, but now that his life seemed daily on the line, he appreciated her all the more. Since the attempt on his life, Zai had recognized that loyalty was a variable trait in the Navy. On Grey Vader, rebellion against authority was rarely contemplated, but a mutiny had happened here on the Lynx. And it had been Cathery Hobbs, a utopian by birth, who had stopped it. In the red work lights, her surgical beauty betrayed the values of her hedonistic homeland. But Hobbs was his best officer as well as his XO. She would make a good captain one day.
Sir!
The sensor officer shouted, pulling Zai from his reverie.
Report.
I'm getting reflections from the Rick's fire.
You mean they've hit something?
Hobbs asked. Zai narrowed his eyes. The Rick's search pattern had passed beyond the Lynx minutes ago. Its spiral course had taken it 100,000 kilometers away.
Yes, ma'am.
The man bent back to his heads-down display. Tyre spoke up.
I'm running an analysis now.
Old sand?
Zai suggested to Hobbs.
Not out here, she said.
Zai nodded. They had put a lot of distance between themselves and their original intercept point.
Maybe it's old Legius's orbital defenses.
That would be fantastic luck, Zai said. If they think they've spotted us, we're home free. But Hobbs shook her head. Zai knew from experience what the look on her face meant. There was a thought half formed in her mind, an unhappy one.
I'm getting oxygen, hydrogen, some carbon, said the sensor officer.
The recyclables,
Hobbs cried.
That's what they were looking for. Why they went so wide with their search. They weren't looking for us. They wanted to find the reaction mass from our cold jets.
Zai closed his eyes.
Of course.
Spreading out from the Lynx was a spray of H2O and organic waste, the ejector from their stealthy acceleration. It would be spread into a huge cloud of ice crystals by now. Boiled by a laser, it would be much easier to spot than a silent starship. The Ricks would eventually calculate its mass and vector. And by extrapolation, they would know the vector of the Lynx. "We seem to have left footprints, Executive Officer," he said.
"Aye, sir,"
Hobbs answered quietly.
"They've gone to a more focused beam, sir," the sensor officer reported. "They're still sounding the ice, tracking it."
"We need to maneuver again, Hobbs," Zai said, "and at better than 1/20th G."
"I'll warn Frick, sir."
Hobbs activated the forward gunnery comm point and sent the runner into motion. The captain sighed. He would have to walk a fine line between two dangers. The Ricks would extrapolate their position before the Lynx passed out of range. If Zai let the frigate coast, the enemy's laser would find them, followed by their gravity cannon. But if he maneuvered too quickly, the unsecured armor plates would roll through the frigate like a gravity goes through a ship of glass.
"What's the strongest part of the cargo area, Hobbs?"
"The forewall, sir," Hobbs answered without hesitation. "It's exterior-grade hull alloy. There's vacuum on the bow side."
"So we'll do the least damage if we thrust sternward."
"Yes, sir. But that only changes our position on the Z-axis. We're facing directly toward the Ricks."
"We need to turn, then. A 1/20th G yaw thrust."
"Any change in yaw and we expose more area to the Ricks, sir."
"Yes, Hobbs. We'll turn back as quickly as possible."
"And I'm not sure how much acceleration we can get, sir. We're pretty low on recyclables."
Zai thought quickly. They needed the greatest possible push from the least possible mass. Thus, they needed maximum velocity.
"We'll use the drone launcher. Not the main rail's magnetics."
The Ricks would spot that in a second.
"The dead man drone. The highest velocity we can get out of it."
Hobbs whistled.
"Without artificial gravity to dampen the reaction?
That will cause a jolt, sir."
"Jolt is what we need, Hobbs, and a mechanical event won't show up on the Ricks' sensors." Hobbs nodded, understanding. The dead man launcher was designed for a ship that had lost power, its systems failing. The launch rail stored its energy mechanically like a huge crossbow made of wound carbon.
"I'll send another runner to the first engineer, Captain. There'll be decompression up there."
Zai nodded, his fingers flexing with frustration. They had only minutes to make this maneuver work, but using runners to convey messages would create at least half a minute of lag time each way. Any change in plan would catch the engineer off guard. Of all Zai's first officers, Engineer Frick most rarely worked from the bridge. The Lynx's captain and engineer didn't know each other's thinking. The words of the war sage came unbidden into Zai's mind. "A true subordinate is an extension of yourself." He came to a decision. "Hobbs, tell Frick you'll be coming forward."
"Sir?"
"We don't know how this is going to work out. More maneuvers may be required. I need you there."
"To do what, sir?"
"To read my mind." Commando. The sensation of freefall was strangely comforting. In their orbital homes, the Ricks generally slept in zero G. Except for the rush of frigid air, Herd might have been waking from some dark dream. But this was real. She was falling toward her death. She could see the entanglement facility in the distance, a concentric pattern of lights against the dull sheen of starlit snow. Somewhere in that pattern, 100 kilometers away, was the landing zone Alexander had prepared for her, but it was much too far away. The world below her was terribly dark. She felt absolutely alone, and thought of Rana, probably still asleep in the cave. Who would bring her food now? Who would mourn her death? Interrupting her thoughts, the scream of the recon flyer passed her, its running lights a red blur. With its fans inverted, it was falling faster than she. But it was 20 meters away. The machine had very limited sensors, nothing that could spot her, even with Alexander at the controls. But Herd remembered the sensitive thermal images that the Imperials had used to hunt her and Rana. She closed her eyes and willed her body temperature upward. Almost immediately, she felt acid in her stomach and a dryness in her mouth. A whirring of the turbine in her chest, the sensations of a heightened metabolism. She dared a glance at the ground rushing toward her. Was there time? Herd cupped her hands, spreading out to slow her fall. She worked her muscles to hurry the heating process, flailing as she fell. The recon flyer suddenly edged back up toward her, moving carefully in the ferocious wind, guided by the barest movements of its control surfaces. Apparently, Alexander could see her against the cold background of the stars. The flyer came alongside and steadied itself. Hurd took control of her descent, angling her cupped hands to maneuver herself toward the craft. She grabbed the flailing webbing of the gunner's seat. The fans screamed again as the recon flyer braked. The machine pulled up from its dive at a precarious angle, Hurd dangling from one side. She looked down as the craft decelerated, the frozen earth rushing toward her. They missed collision with the hard tundra by only a few hundred meters. "Well, then," she said. Talking to herself was an odd habit she had picked up from Rana. "At least I've had a practice run." Executive Officer. Exo Kathary Hobbs pulled herself through the dark shaftways of the Lynx, wishing she'd put more time into zero-G practice. Normally, before an engagement, the crew would spend days working out in variable and zero-G, preparing for evasive maneuvers and gravity generator brownouts. But the Lynx had been under heavy acceleration for almost 10 days. There'd been no chance for the usual touch-up exercises. End of side 2. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over. Side 3. The Killing of Worlds by Scott Westerfeld, continuing on page 99. At least the captain had given her time to don a proper pressure suit. Hobbs checked the ancient chronometer on her wrist. The captain had set the first yaw axis maneuver for 30 seconds from now, and he had loaned Hobbs his grandfather's timepiece. Good God, the thing was old. It used some ancient circular readout that Zai had explained as she'd slipped into an armored pressure suit. The timepiece was analog, he had said, using an almost forgotten meaning of that word. As she moved through the cold and silent passageways of the ship, Hobbs's ears registered the almost subliminal pulse of the timepiece's ticking. 30 seconds. She wouldn't make it before the first acceleration, a nudge to orient the Lynx away from the Rick's warship, but that would be a small one. The dead man launch would come 20 seconds later, releasing the potential energy stored in the backup drone rail would shove Lynx off its current trajectory, rocking the ship like a meteor collision. Unlike cold jet acceleration, there would be no smooth build-up. The jolt would come all at once. The first engineer had already been warned by runners, but if she were to help Frick, she had to make it to the bow before things got too chaotic. Even as Hobbs had left the bridge, the chief sensor officer was warning that the Rix's laser beams had ceased probing the ejector and were closing on the Lynx. At any second, they could be under fire. She pushed herself forward with abandon, kicking against the grabby walls as she yanked her pressure hood over her head. At least if she cracked her skull, the suit's thick carapace would afford it an extra layer of protection. Suddenly, her ankle became tangled in something. She was yanked up short, swearing at whoever had left cable floating free under battle stations. But then Hobbs was pulled back forcibly, and she realized that a strong hand held her foot. "What the hell?" she shouted. Who was playing around here in the midst of battle? Hobbs bent her knees, bringing herself face to face with the assailant, prepared to unleash a mighty stream of invective. Then she recognized the woman. Verity Anst, a fourth-class gunnery rating, and an old friend of Gunner Thompson. Anst was one of those whom Hobbs and Zai had suspected of sympathy with the mutiny. They had never caught the last two mutineers. The Lynx was short of gunners, however, and no proof had ever come to light against Anst. They had put her under maximum surveillance, assuming that the ship's monitors would keep her honest. In dark mode, of course, the Lynx was as blind as it was silent. Hobbs turned and tried to push away, but Gunner Anst's hold was firm. The gunner's stats flitted across Hobbs's mind. 2 meters tall, 90 kilograms. Anst held on, spinning Hobbs against a bulkhead with a crack that knocked the wind from her. She pulled Hobbs toward her and held a knife to the Exo's throat. The blade was ceremonial, but looked hellishly lethal as it flashed in the red battle lights. "Our little traitor," Anst said, her face only centimeters away. Hobbs felt the cold steel even through the pressure suit's plastic. She forced down panic. "I wasn't the traitor, Anst. Thompson revered you, Hobbs. He wanted you. Poor bastard couldn't see what a captain's whore you were." The executive officer blinked, suppressed emotions rising in her briefly. She forced them down. "So you were one of them, Anst. I always suspected." "I know you did, Kathary," the woman said. "I felt you waiting for me to give myself away. But I've been waiting for you, too. As the woman spoke, Hobbs felt a familiar complaint from her inner ear. The ship was turning, shifting slowly around its Y-axis. Here, amidships, the maneuver was subtle enough that the grinning woman before her probably hadn't noticed it.
"You played it well, Verity, but you're dead now," Hobbs said. She glanced sidelong at the chronometer, starting a countdown from 20.
"We won't be in dark mode forever."
"We'll see about that." With her free hand, Anst yanked open the hatch on the hull side wall, an escape pod. The executive officer swallowed.
"I've got a few minutes with you," Anst said in a whisper. "You, me, and this knife. And then off you go with a load of H.E. Zai won't find enough of you to genoprint. I planned this well."
Fine, Hobbs thought. Anst wanted to brag. Let her. Kathy Hobbs willed her body to relax, counting down the few remaining seconds before the coming jolt. First engineer. Metal screamed all around the first engineer.
"Get to the far wall,"
he shouted to his team. Damn that idiot, Zai. He was turning the links too fast, Frick thought. But then the engineer saw the error he'd made, the realization coming even as he leaped from the shifting mass of armor plates. He had given Zai an absolute limit on acceleration, 1/20th of a G, or 0.5 meter per second squared. But that assumed forward or backward thrust, which had an even effect throughout the frigate. Thrusting the ship into a turn, however, worked like a centrifugal gravity simulator. The force was far greater at the ship's bow and stern than it was at the center. Frick was like a man at the end of a whip, one that Zai had casually snapped. Rating Metasmith had returned from the comm point with a warning about the maneuver, but she hadn't been told why the captain was turning the ship. It didn't make sense. The plan had been to stay oriented to the Ricks. As always, someone was improvising. Frick cursed himself as a fool not to have specifically warned against this. The plates explosively popped their strongline tethers and began to pile toward the starboard side of the cargo bay. They weren't moving fast enough to punch through the hull alloy exterior wall, but they were plenty massive enough to crush a crewman. As one, the engineering team pulled their magnets and jumped toward the sternward wall. The sliding plates rubbed against each other, screeching like a heavy maglev engaging friction brakes. But his team was clear.
"Well, the captain hasn't killed us yet," he said as they landed around him.
A few of his team laughed, but Rating Metasmith raised her fist for their attention.
"They said only 1/20th for the first Excel, but much higher for the second, whatever they can muster."
"Splendid," Frick muttered, then cried. "Get your hoods on and tether with hard lines. We're going into vacuum." 10 seconds later, the promised second jolt struck. It was far worse than Frick expected. Executive officer. Hobbs's feet shot out as her count hit 20, catching Verity Anst in the center of her chest. Her timing was perfect. The woman cried out in surprise as the ship bucked around them, the shock as violent as a collision. The force of Hobbs's kick was trebled by the sudden acceleration. She was flung from Anst's grip toward the bow and rolled into a tumbling ball, bouncing down the corridor like a stone tossed down a well. But Hobbs felt pain at her throat. Anst had managed to cut her as she'd pushed away. Hobbs felt the wound as she tumbled in freefall. Her fingers came away slick, but there was no spurting gout of blood. She came to a hard stop against a closed hatchway, cracking one shoulder, hand still at her throat. The integrity of her suit was broken, but the thick neck seal had saved her life by millimeters. Hobbs glanced down the corridor. Anst was 20 meters behind, kicking her way toward Hobbs with knife leveled. A huge roar came from behind the executive officer, a shriek of metal and a howling wind from the bow. Damn, Hobbs thought. In the burst of acceleration sternward, the armor plates must have punched through the bow of the ship. The Lynx was depressurizing. Hobbs wasn't far from the bow cargo bay. She glanced at the pressure meter on the hatchway door. It was dropping into the red. She spun the hatch's manual seal, and its safeties complained. Hobbs pressed her hand to the ID plate, and the hatch relented to her command rank. Gunner Anst was flying toward her, the outstretched knife a few meters away. Hobbs barely had time to belt-clip herself to the wall before the hatch blew open. A great sudden wind yanked her hard against the clip, bending Hobbs at the waist like a jackknife. Verity Anst sailed past helplessly, screaming bloody murder, and was sucked through the hatch like a doll into a tornado. Hobbs felt a stinging along one arm. Anst had managed to cut her again.
"Damn you!"
she cried. In a few seconds, the wind began to die down.
Somewhere further toward the bow, spray foam must be sealing the breaches. Hobbs pulled her pressure suit's face mask on and extended strong line from her belt clip.